Chapter 3. The Brontes, the Z-Boys, and the Renaissance. Excellence is a habit. Aristotle. The Girls from Nowhere. In the vast river of narratives that make up Western culture, most stories about talent are strikingly similar. They go like this. Without warning, in the midst of ordinary, everyday life, a kid from nowhere appears. The kid possesses a mysterious natural gift for painting, math, baseball, physics, and through the power of that gift, he changes his life and the lives of those around him. This narrative of the divinely inspired artist is so tightly woven into our culture that it's easy to forget that there was a time when it didn't exist. Prior to the Italian Renaissance, skill at painting and sculpting was regarded as a useful craft, equivalent to masonry or weaving. Then, however, a painter named Giorgio Vasari invented the idea of the heroic artist. For his 1550 book, Lives of the Artists, he told the story of a wandering shepherd boy named Giotto, who was discovered in a field drawing marvellous sketches with a sharpened piece of stone, and who went on to become the first great artist of the Renaissance. Never mind that the story is historically unsubstantiated, or that, more to Meyerlin's point, Giotto also spent years apprenticing to the master painter Cimabue. Vasari's irresistible notion of the divinely inspired low-born child, which, after all, is not without its useful resonances, made for a marvellously captivating story, and has proved durable and adaptable to many other fields. Of all the compelling stories of youthful talent, the story of the Bronte sisters is tough to beat. Its essential arc was established by Elizabeth Gaskell in her 1857 Life of Charlotte Bronte. It went like this. Far off in the remote moors of Haworth, West Yorkshire, within a draughty parsonage ruled by their icy, tyrannical father, three motherless sisters named Charlotte, Emily, and Anne wrote marvellous books before dying at a young age. In Gaskell's telling, the Brontes' story was a tragic fable, and the most magical part was that the children produced several of the greatest works of English literature: Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, Agnes Grey, and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. The proof of their divine gift, Gaskell wrote, was the series of tiny books the Brontes created as children, books that wove fantastical stories of imaginary kingdoms called Glasstown, Angria, and Gondal. As Gaskell related, I have had a curious packet confided to me, containing an immense amount of manuscript in an inconceivably small space, tales, dramas, poems, romances written principally by Charlotte, in a hand which is almost impossible to decipher without the aid of a magnifying glass. When she gives way to her powers of creation, her fancy and her language alike run riot, sometimes to the very borders of apparent delirium. Tiny books, delirium, supernaturally gifted children, it's high-octane stuff. Gaskell's book established a sturdy template into which most subsequent Bronte biographies have faithfully slid, in part due to the scarcity of original documents. Gaskell's narrative has been employed for a film, a stage play, and a morality tale. There's just one problem with Gaskell's narrative. It isn't true. To put it more precisely, the real story of the Brontes is even better. The real story of the Brontes was uncovered by Juliet Barker, an Oxford-trained historian who spent 6 years as curator of the Bronte Parsonage Museum in Haworth. Scouring sources locally as well as across Europe, Barker assembled a trove of material that had gone mostly unexamined. In 1994, she systematically demolished Gaskell's myth with a 1,003-page firehose of scholarship called The Brontes. In Barker's work, a fresh picture comes into focus. The town of Haworth was not a remote outpost, but a moderately busy crossroads of politics and commerce. The Bronte home was a far more stimulating place than Gaskell portrayed, replete with books, current magazines, and toys, overseen by a benign, tolerant father. But the myth Barker upends most completely is the assertion that the Brontes were natural-born novelists. The first little books weren't just amateurish, a given since their authors were so young. they lacked any signs of incipient genius. Far from original creations, they were bald imitations of magazine articles and books of the day, in which the three sisters and their brother Branwell copied themes of exotic adventure and melodramatic romance, mimicking the voices of famous authors and cribbing characters wholesale. Barker's work conclusively establishes two facts about the Brontes' little books. First, they wrote a great deal in a variety of forms, 22 little books averaging 80 pages each in one 15-month period. And second, their writing, while complicated and fantastical, wasn't very good. Here's an early example. An immense and terrible monster, his head touched the clouds, was encircled with a red and fiery halo, his nostrils flashed forth flames and smoke, and he was enveloped in dim, misty and indefinable robe. And so on. Reading their little books makes you realise that for the Brontes the act of writing was profoundly social, sort of like playing Dungeons and Dragons, except, of course, that the Brontes had the challenge and privilege of inventing the whole thing. As Barker put it, their slapdash writing, appalling spelling and non-existent punctuation well into their late teenage years is usually glossed over by Bronte biographers, as is the frequent immaturity of thought and characterisation. These elements in the juvenilia do not detract from the Brontes' achievement in producing such a volume of literature at so early an age, but they do extensively undermine the view that they were born novelists. Deep practice and myelin give us a better way to look at the Brontes. The unskilled quality of their early writing isn't a contradiction of the literary heights they eventually achieved. It's a prerequisite to it. They became great writers not in spite of the fact that they started out immature and imitative, but because they were willing to spend vast amounts of time and energy being immature and imitative, building myelin in the confined, safe space of their little books. Their childhood writings were collaborative, deep practice, where they developed storytelling muscles. As Michael Howe wrote of the Brontes in Genius Explained, "The fact that the creative activity of writing about an invented world was a joint exercise contributed enormously to the author's enjoyment. It was a marvellous game in which each participant eagerly ingested and responded to their sibling's latest instalment." To write a book, even a tiny one, is to play a particular kind of game. Rules must be formed and obeyed. Characters must be conceived and constructed. Landscapes must be described. Lines of narrative must be puzzled out and followed. Each of these can be thought of as a distinct action, the firing of a circuit that's linked to other circuits. Written far from parental eyes, removed from any formal pressure, the little books functioned as the equivalent of a link trainer, a place where the Bronte sisters fired and honed millions upon millions of circuits, tangled and untangled thousands of authorial knots, and created hundreds of works that were utter artistic failures, except for two redeeming facts. Each one made them happy, and each one quietly earned them a bit of skill. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. When Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights was published in 1847, reviewers marvelled at the author's originality. Here was a complex masterpiece of imaginative storytelling, featuring the frightening, fascinating character of Heathcliff, a brooding outsider whose only redeeming characteristic was his love for free-spirited Catherine, who tragically marries the wealthy, refined Edgar Linton. Critics were right to marvel, but wrong about the originality. In the scribbles of the little books we can find all the elements waiting to be assembled. The misty, poetic landscape, called Gondal. The dark hero, christened Julius Brenzaida. The headstrong heroine, Augusta Geraldine Almeida, and the rich suitor, Lord Alfred. Seen in this light, it's not surprising that Emily Bronte was able to write the story so well. After all, she had been deep practicing it for quite some time. The Myelin Skaters. In the mid-1970s, the world of skateboarding was turned upside down by a small group of kids who called themselves the Z-Boys. A band of lanky, sun-bleached teenagers from a surf shop near Venice, California, the Z-Boys skated in a way no one had ever seen. They did aerial manoeuvres. They scraped their boards along curbs and handrails. They carried themselves with a punk outsider sensibility that we now recognise as the sport's lingua franca. Most usefully, they had a gift for dramatic timing, making their debut at the Barn Cadillac Skateboard Championship in Del Mar, California, in the summer of 1975. According to witnesses, the Z-Boys were mysterious outsiders, raw-boned geniuses who had descended on the previously sedate sport with all the impact, if not the subtlety, of Genghis Khan. As the London Guardian summed up in its review of a documentary film on the Z-Boys, "As Jay Adams slips into a loose crouch, grabs both ends of his board and hops up and down in a burst of explosive energy speeding across the platform, the implication is clear already. In his charge, a skateboard is no longer a piece of sporting equipment like a tennis racket. Instead, it's more like an electric guitar, an instrument for aggressive, irreverent, spontaneous self-expression." But such expression was, in fact, far from spontaneous. Most of the Z-Boys were dedicated ocean surfers, having logged hundreds of hours on their boards. On days when the waves failed to show, they had simply transferred their aggressive, low-slung surfer style to the street. Another factor in their rise to greatness was more accidental: the discovery, in the early 1970s, of a unique tool, a myelin accelerant that allowed them to improve their circuitry at a ferocious speed. That tool was an empty swimming pool. Thanks to a combination of drought, fire, and overbuilt real estate, the neighbourhoods of Bel Air and Beverly Hills were rife with empty pools. Finding them was easy. The Z-Boys drove down side streets with a scout standing on the roof of their car, scanning over fences for likely venues. Riding the pool's steep, curved walls was difficult at first. The first days brought some spectacular wipeouts, not to mention more than a few police calls from surprised homeowners. But sometime in 1975, in a moment that qualifies as skateboarding's version of the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, the Z-Boys achieved liftoff. "When we hit the pools, it became a really serious activity. The most serious activity," said Skip Engblom, part owner of the surf shop and the group's de facto mentor. "Every time we had to go bigger, faster, longer. We were like a painter with a new canvas." In Skateboard Kings, a 1978 British documentary, a skater identified as Ken described the experience. "Pool riding is definitely the hardest thing to do," he said. "It takes whole body coordination, so different than any other part of skateboarding. But, like, when I'm doing it, I flash on certain things, like I'm coming up to the top, I hit the top, and I feel if it's a good connection or not, and that will either send me into a slide across the top, or else I go for air. You're just out there, and then you just want to make it, and you feel more air and more air, and if you have it under control, you just totally go for it." Consider the pattern of actions that Ken describes. The space and shape of the pool constrain his efforts and narrow his focus to certain flashes, to certain connections that are either made or not made. It's fly high or fall hard. There are no grey areas, no mushiness. Once inside the pool, sliding along the steep surface, the Z-Boys had to play by the rules of the new game. From a deep practice point of view, the empty swimming pool created a world not unlike that of the little books of the Bronte sisters, or the futsal courts of Brazil. Circuits are fired and honed, mistakes are made and corrected. Myelin flourishes, talent blooms. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. For the last few hundred years, Western culture has understood and explained talent using the idea of unique identity, the tumble of cosmic dice that makes everyone different and a few lucky people special. According to that way of thinking, the Brontes and the Z-boys succeeded because they were exceptional, mysteriously gifted outsiders, destiny-kissed kids from nowhere. Seen through the lens of deep practice, however, the story flips. Uniqueness still matters, but its significance resides in the way the Brontes and the Z-boys do the things necessary to build their remarkable skills. Firing the right signals, honing circuits, making tiny books and filling them with childish stories, searching out empty swimming pools so that they can spend hours riding and falling inside them. The truth is, plenty of other Yorkshire girls had lives just as parochial and constricted as the Brontes, just as plenty of other Los Angeles kids were as edgy and cool as the Z-boys. But Myelin doesn't care about who you are. It only cares about what you do. We've seen how deep practice and Myelin illuminate the talents of small groups of people. Now let's apply those ideas to two slightly larger groups. First, we'll look at the artists of the Italian Renaissance. Then, we'll look at a slightly bigger group, the human species. The Michelangelo System. A few years ago, a Carnegie Mellon University statistician named David Banks wrote a short paper entitled The Problem of Excess Genius. Geniuses are not scattered uniformly through time and space, he pointed out. To the contrary, they tend to appear in clusters. The most important question we can ask of historians is, why are some periods and places so astonishingly more productive than the rest? Banks wrote. It is intellectually embarrassing that this is almost never posed squarely, although its answer would have thrilling implications for education, politics, science, and art. Banks singled out three main clusters of greatness: Athens from 440 BC to 380 BC, Florence from 440 to 490, and London from 1570 to 1640. Of these three, none is so dazzling or well documented as Florence. In the space of a few generations, a city with a population slightly less than that of present-day Stillwater, Oklahoma, produced the greatest outpouring of artistic achievement the world has ever known. A solitary genius is easy to understand, but dozens of them, in the space of two generations? How could it happen? Banks listed the conventional wisdom explanations for the Renaissance. Prosperity, which provided money and markets to support art. Peace, which provided the stability to seek artistic and philosophical progress. Freedom, which liberated artists from state or religious control. Social mobility, which allowed talented poor people to enter the arts. The paradigm thing, which brought new perspectives and mediums that created a wave of originality and expression. All of these seem to be likely causes, Banks wrote, and it is superficially plausible that, by remarkable good fortune, they converged to spark the Renaissance. Unfortunately, he continued, the actual existence of most of these factors is contradicted by the historical record. While socially mobile, Florence in the 1400s wasn't unusually prosperous, peaceful, or free. In fact, the city was recovering from a disastrous plague, was divided by vigorous fighting among powerful families, and was ruled by the church's iron fist. So, the usual thinking goes, perhaps it's the reverse. Perhaps it's the infighting, plagues, and restrictive church that formed the convergence. And yet this logic, too, collapses under its own weight, since there are plenty of other places that had these factors present and yet did not produce anything resembling Florence's collection of great artistic talent. Banks's paper neatly illustrates the endless cycle of tail-chasing that ensues when you apply traditional nature-nurture thinking to questions of talent. The more you try to distill the vast ocean of potential factors into a golden concentrate of uniqueness, the more contradictory the evidence becomes, and the more you are nudged towards the seemingly inescapable conclusion that geniuses are simply born, and that phenomena like the Renaissance were thus a product of blind luck. As historian Paul Johnson writes, giving voice to that theory, genius suddenly comes to life and speaks out of a vacuum, and then it is silent, equally mysteriously. Now, let's look at the problem through the prism of deep practice. Myelin doesn't care about prosperity, peace, or paradigms. It doesn't care what the church was doing, or who died in the plague, or how much money anyone had in the bank. It asks the same questions we ask of the Brontes and the Z-Boys. What did Florentine artists do? How did they practice? And for how long? As it turns out, Florence was an epicenter for the rise of a powerful social invention called craft guilds. Guilds, the word means gold, were associations of weavers, painters, goldsmiths, and the like who organized themselves to regulate competition and control quality. Guilds worked like employee-owned corporations. They had management, dues, and tight policies dictating who could work in the craft. What they did best, however, was grow talent. Guilds were built on the apprenticeship system, in which boys around 7 years of age were sent to live with masters for fixed terms of 5 to 10 years. An apprentice worked directly under the tutelage and supervision of the master, who frequently assumed rights as the child's legal guardian. Apprentices learned the craft from the bottom up, not through lecture or theory, but through action, mixing paint, preparing canvases, sharpening chisels. They cooperated and competed within a hierarchy, rising after some years to the status of journeyman, and eventually, if they were skilled enough, master. This system created a chain of mentoring. Da Vinci studied under Verrocchio. Verrocchio studied under Donatello. Donatello studied under Ghiberti. Michelangelo studied under Ghirlandaio. Ghirlandaio studied under Baldovinetti, and so on. All of them frequently visiting one another's studios in a cooperative, competitive arrangement that today would be called social networking. The system lasted until the 1500s, when powerful new nation-states rose up to put an end to the guilds, and with them, the deep practice engine of the Renaissance. In short, apprentices spent thousands of hours solving problems, trying and failing, and trying again, within the confines of a world built on the systematic production of excellence. Their life was roughly akin to that of a 12-year-old intern who spends a decade under the direct supervision of Steven Spielberg, painting sets, sketching storyboards, setting cameras. The notion that such a kid might one day become a great film director would hardly be a surprise. It would be closer to unavoidable. See Ron Howard. Consider Michelangelo. From ages 6 to 10, he lived with a stonecutter and his family, learning how to handle a hammer and chisel before he could read and write. After a brief, unhappy attempt at schooling, he apprenticed to the great Ghirlandaio. He worked on blockbuster commissions, sketching, copying, and preparing frescoes in one of Florence's largest churches. He was then taught by master sculptor Bertoldo, and tutored by other luminaries at the home of Lorenzo de' Medici, where Michelangelo lived until he was 17. He was a promising but little-known artist until he produced the Pietà at age 24. People called the Pietà pure genius, but its creator begged to differ. "If people knew how hard I had to work to gain my mastery," Michelangelo later said, "it would not seem so wonderful at all." The apprenticeship system, with its long period of study, early acquaintance with varied materials, copying and collaborative work, somehow allowed boys who were probably quite ordinary in every respect to be turned into men possessing a high degree of artistic skill, wrote Bruce Cole in The Renaissance Artist at Work. Art, so the Renaissance believed, could be taught by a series of progressive steps from grinding colours to making copies, to work on the master's design, to inventing one's own paintings or sculptures. We tend to think of the great Renaissance artists as a homogeneous group, but the truth is that they were like any other randomly selected group of people. They came from rich and poor families alike. They had different personalities, different teachers, different motivations, but they had one thing in common. They all spent thousands of hours inside a deep practice hothouse, firing and optimizing circuits, correcting errors, competing and improving skills. They each took part in the greatest work of art anyone can construct, the architecture of their own talent. Meet Mr. Myelin. George Bartsokis is a professor of neurology at UCLA. Most of the time, Bartsokis, who's in his 50s, resembles the sober, distinguished researcher and teacher he is. Shirt and tie, neatly combed hair, courtly manner. But when he talks about Myelin, something within him quickens. He leans forward hungrily. His eyes gleam. He smiles hugely. He looks as if he might suddenly leap out of his chair. Bartsokis does not want to behave in this way, but he can't help it. Around UCLA, he is known as Mr. Myelin. "Why do teenagers make bad decisions?" he asks, not waiting for an answer. "Because all the neurons are there, but they are not fully insulated. Until the whole circuit is insulated, that circuit, although capable, will not be instantly available to alter impulsive behavior as it's happening. Teens understand right and wrong, but it takes them time to figure it out. Why is wisdom most often found in older people? Because their circuits are fully insulated and instantly available to them. They can do very complicated processing on many levels, which is really what wisdom is. The volume of myelin in the brain continues to increase until around 50, and you have to remember that it is alive. It is breaking down and we are rebuilding it. Complex tasks like ruling countries or writing novels, these are most often better done by people who have built the most myelin. Why can't monkeys, which have every neuron type and neurotransmitter we have, use language the way we do?" he continues. "Because we've got 20% more myelin. To talk like we are now takes a lot of information processing speed, and they have no broadband. Sure, you can teach a monkey to communicate at the level of a 3-year-old, but beyond that, they are using the equivalent of copper wires." Bartsokis keeps going, posing more questions, providing more answers, some documented, others awaiting the proof he knows will soon come. "Why do breastfed babies have higher IQs? Because the fatty acids in breast milk are the building blocks of myelin. This is why the FDA recently approved the addition of omega-3 fatty acids to infant formula, and also why eating fish, which is rich in fatty acids, has been linked to lowered risk of memory loss, dementia, and Alzheimer's disease. Bartsokis takes DHA fatty acids daily. The lesson in all cases is the same. The more myelin you have on board, the smarter you can be." "Why did Michael Jordan retire?" "His muscles didn't change, but, as with every other human being, his myelin started to break down with age. Not much, but enough to prevent him from firing impulses at the speeds and frequencies required for Michael Jordan-esque explosive movement." "Why was puny Cro-Magnon man able to survive when bigger, stronger, larger-brained Neanderthals died out?" "Because Cro-Magnons had more myelin. They could outthink, outcommunicate, and ultimately outcompete the Neanderthals." Bartsokis is awaiting DNA testing of a Neanderthal tooth that he says may confirm his hypothesis. "Why can horses walk immediately on being born while humans take a year?" "A horse is born with its muscles already myelinated, online, and ready to go. A baby's muscles, on the other hand, don't get myelinated for a year or so, and the circuits get optimized only with practice." In selecting for myelin, evolution made the same choice that any engineer designing the internet would make, Bartsokis says. It traded size of the computer for bandwidth. "I don't care how big your computers are, what I want is to have them available instantaneously, so I can fully process things now. That's what the internet is, instant access to lots of computers. We operate by the same principles as Google does. We are myelin beings," Bartsokis says finally. "It's the way we're built. You can't avoid it." We are myelin beings. This is a big statement. It offers a potentially revolutionary alternative to the traditional way we think about skill, talent, and human nature itself. To see what Mr. Myelin really means by it, however, we must first backtrack a moment. Since Darwin, the traditional way of thinking about talent has gone something like this. Genes, nature, and environment, nurture, combine to make us who we are. The phrase, nature versus nurture, was not originally Darwin's, but that of Sir Francis Galton, his lesser-known cousin, who spent a good portion of his life energetically but futilely trying to prove that genius was heritable. In this view, genes are the cosmic cards we are dealt, and the environment is the game in which they are played. Every once in a while, fate produces a perfect combination of genes and environment, resulting in high levels of talent and/or genius. Nature-nurture has been a terrifically popular model because it's clear and dramatic, and it speaks to a wide variety of phenomena in the natural world. But when it comes to explaining human talent, it has a slight problem. It's vague to the point of meaninglessness. Thinking that talent comes from genes and environment is like thinking that cookies come from sugar, flour, and butter. It's true enough, but not sufficiently detailed to be useful. To get beyond the outmoded nature-nurture model, we need to begin with a clear picture of how genes actually work. Genes are not cosmic playing cards. They are evolution-tested instruction books that build the immensely complicated machines that are us. They contain the blueprints, literally written in nucleotides, to construct our minds and bodies in the smallest detail. The task of design and construction is hugely complex, but essentially straightforward. The genes instruct the cells to make the eyelash like this, the toenail like that. When it comes to behaviour, however, genes are forced to deal with a unique design challenge. Human beings move around through a big, varied world. They encounter all sorts of dangers, opportunities, and novel experiences. Things happen quickly, which means that behaviour, skills, needs to change quickly. The challenge is, how do you write an instruction book for behaviour? How do our genes, sitting quietly inside our cells, help us adapt to an ever-changing, ever-dangerous world? To help address this problem, our genes have evolved to do a sensible thing. They contain instructions to build our circuitry with preset urges, proclivities, instincts. Genes construct our brains so that when we encounter certain stimuli, a tasty meal, rotting meat, a stalking tiger, or a potential mate, a factory-loaded neural program kicks into gear, using emotions to guide our behaviour in a useful direction. We feel hunger when we smell a meal, disgust when we smell rotten meat, fear when we see a tiger, desire when we see a potential mate. Guided by these preset neural programs, we navigate toward a solution. That strategy works well for creating behaviours to deal with rotten meat and potential mates. After all, writing instructions to build an urge circuit is relatively simple. If X, then Y. But what about creating complex, higher behaviours, like playing the saxophone or Scrabble? As we've seen, higher skills are made of million neuron chains working together with exquisite millisecond timing. The question of acquiring higher skills is really a question of design strategy. What's the best strategy for writing instructions to build a machine that can learn immensely complicated skills? One obvious design strategy would be for the genes to pre-wire for the skill. The genes would provide detailed step-by-step instructions to build the precise circuits needed to perform the desired skill, to play music, or juggle, or do calculus. When the right stimulus came along, all the pre-built wiring would connect up and start firing away, and the talent would appear. Babe Ruth starts whacking homers, Beethoven starts composing symphonies. This design strategy would seem to make sense. After all, what could be more straightforward? But in fact, it has two big problems. First, it's expensive, biologically speaking. Building those elaborate circuits takes resources and time, which have to come at the expense of some other design feature. Second, it's a gamble with fate. Pre-wiring to create a genius software programmer doesn't help if it's 1850, and pre-wiring for a genius blacksmith would be useless today. In the space of a generation or a few hundred miles, certain higher skills flip from being crucial to being trivial, and vice versa. To put it simply, pre-wiring a million-wire circuit for a complex higher skill is a stupid and expensive bet for genes to make. Our genes, however, having survived the gauntlet of the past few million years, aren't in the business of making stupid and expensive bets. Other genes might have been, but they're long gone by now, along with the lineages that carried them. That's not to say that pre-wiring for complex behaviour doesn't exist. For instance, look at bees and their flower-locating dance, or the mating rituals of any number of animals. But pre-wiring for those behaviours makes good evolutionary sense. They are crucial to survival, while playing piano and hitting a golf ball are not. Well, mostly. Now, let's consider a different design strategy. Instead of pre-wiring for specific skills, what if the genes dealt with the skill issue by building millions of tiny broadband installers and distributing them throughout the circuits of the brain? The broadband installers wouldn't be particularly complicated. In fact, they'd all be identical, wrapping wires with insulation to make the circuits work faster and smoother. They would work according to a single rule. Whatever circuits are fired most, and most urgently, are the ones where the installers will go. Skill circuits that are fired often will receive more broadband. Skills that are fired less often, with less urgency, will receive less broadband. Such broadband installers would be useful if they were preset to work most vigorously during youth, when we're adapting to our environment. They'd be efficient if they worked outside of our consciousness without cluttering up the limited window of everyday experience. After all, from a natural selection point of view, it doesn't matter if we feel ourselves gaining the crucial skill, only that we gain it. Similar to the workings of, say, our immune system. From our limited vantage point, the increased skill would feel exactly like a gift, as if we were expressing some natural-born quality. But it would not be a gift. The real gift would be the tiny broadband installers busily insulating whatever circuits were being fired, whether for hunting, math, music, or sport. Like all useful adaptations, the broadband installer system would quickly have become standard operating equipment among the entire species. We are myelin beings. The broadband is myelin, and the installers are the green, squid-like oligodendrocytes, sensing the signals we send and insulating the corresponding circuits. When we acquire higher skills, we are co-opting this ancient adaptive mechanism to our individual ends, an event made possible by the fact that our genes let us, or more accurately, they let our needs and our actions, determine what skills we grow. This system is flexible, responsive, and economical because it gives all human beings the innate potential to earn skill where they need it. The proof lies in the talent hotbeds, in the 10,000 hours people spend deep practicing their way to world-class expertise, even in the strained Clint Eastwood facial expressions they share. These similarities are not accidental. They are the logical expression of a shared evolutionary mechanism built to respond to certain kinds of signals. Skill is insulation that wraps neural circuits and grows according to certain signals. In 1985, Dr. Marion Diamond found that the left inferior parietal lobe of Einstein's brain, though it had an average number of neurons, had significantly more glial cells, which produce and support myelin, than the average person's brain. At the time, the finding was considered so meaningless as to be nearly comical. But now it makes perfect sense, bandwidth-wise. This is not to say that every person on the planet has the potential to become an Einstein, whose autopsied brain was found to contain an unusual amount of you-know-what, nor does it mean that our genes don't matter. They do. The point, rather, is that although talent feels and looks predestined, In fact, we have a good deal of control over what skills we develop, and we each have more potential than we might ever presume to guess. We are all born with the opportunity to become, as Mr. Myelin likes to put it, lords of our own internet. The trick is to figure out how to do that.